Imagine you have this incredibly brilliant, charismatic friend,
Okay.
the kind of person who leaves you these hilarious, expressive voice notes and is always sending you spontaneous selfies of whatever they happen to be up to.
Yeah, the really fun friends.
Exactly. But there is a catch. They only interact that way with everyone else in your friend group.
Uh-oh.
When they communicate with you, for whatever reason, it is exclusively through sterile, plain text messages.
Oh, wow. Yeah, that would feel incredibly isolating. You would
Right.
constantly feel like you were getting the, I don't know, the downgraded, stripped back version of the relationship while everyone else got the full experience.
You would be completely missing out on the magic. And that tension, between the rich experience some people get and the flat experience others get
Yeah.
is exactly what we are exploring today.
It is a great topic.
Welcome to the Deep Dive. We are thrilled you are joining us today. We have a really unique set of source materials for you this time.
We do. It is a developer's update.
Yeah, specifically a post titled V0.1.1 Feature Parity, which chronicles the evolution of an AI agent framework named Mio.
MIO, right.
Exactly. Our mission for today's deep dive is to explore the fascinating and honestly sometimes messy gap between building a cool prototype and engineering a mature product.
Because those are two very different things.
Huge difference. We are going to look at how software designers have to balance deep human empathy on the user-facing side with, well, cold, ruthless pragmatism on the back end.
Right.
Okay, let's unpack this, because on the surface, reading about a software update sounds like a dry technical manual.
It really
But
does.
underneath the code, this document is essentially a masterclass in product psychology.
It totally is. What's fascinating here is the context of the version number itself. We are looking at a tiny bump. I mean, going from version 1.1 to 0.1.1.
Barely a blip.
Exactly. In standard software development, a 0.0.1 increment usually signals like trivial bug fixes.
Right, like maybe fixing a typo in a menu or patching a minor visual glitch.
Yeah, exactly. But reading through this developer's post, it becomes immediately clear that this tiny numerical change masks a massive architectural leap.
It is huge.
It represents a total overhaul in both how the user experiences the AI and how the system manages its own hygiene behind the scenes.
Let's start with that feeling of being left out, which the developer specifically calls the asymmetry problem.
Friend who only texts.
Yes, let's go back to that brilliant friend who only texts you. That scenario was the reality for the web users of this AI, Mio,
It was.
because Mio operates as a bot on Telegram as well. And those Telegram users were receiving these fantastic immersive voice messages powered by a service called Phish Audio.
Right, and selfies.
Yeah, alongside selfie images generated by Gemini. But if you logged into Mio through a standard web browser,
Crickets.
nothing. Well, the underlying system was trying to send the media, but it was just silently dropping into the void. You saw text and literally nothing else.
And fixing that asymmetry is far more complex than just flipping a toggle switch to on somewhere in the code.
It wasn't just a bug.
No, not at all. The web front end literally lacked the vocabulary to process or display those media files. The developer had to fundamentally re-engineer the conversation between the server and the browser.
Wow. Okay, how did they do that?
By introducing server-sent events, or SSE, as a first-class media type.
Okay, for the non-engineers among us, we probably need an analogy for that. How does an SSE differ from how browsers normally talk to servers?
Think of the traditional method, which is called polling, like a kid in the back seat of a car,
Oh boy.
constantly asking, "Are we there yet? Do you have a picture for me? Are we there yet? Do you have a picture for me?"
Just constantly nagging the server.
Exactly. The browser has to keep knocking on the server's door. It is incredibly inefficient. It drains battery life, and it just wastes server resources.
So what does server-sent events do instead?
Well, server-sent events open a single continuous one-way pipe. It is more like tuning into a radio broadcast.
Oh, I see.
Yeah, the server uploads the generated selfie or voice note to cloud storage and then just silently slides that URL right down the open pipe to the client.
So the connection just stays open.
Yes, it stays open, no constant asking, no separate API calls, it just flows.
That is so much cleaner. And that perfectly sets up the back-end mechanism. But once the browser actually receives that voice file, it needs a visual container.
Right, the user has to interact with it.
Exactly, it has to look like something.
Yeah.
And this is where the product psychology really shines. The developer didn't try to invent some, I don't know, futuristic sci-fi audio player.
Yeah, they went with something very familiar.
They simply mirrored the WeChat voice interface. They built a clean green bubble with three animated sound wave bars.
It is brilliant.
They even use CSS keyframes, which is just code that dictates how an animation plays out over time, to stagger the movement of those bars by 100 milliseconds so they pulse naturally.
The attention to detail there is crazy.
It really is. It is the digital equivalent of using universal street signs. I mean, why on earth would an urban planner invent a new abstract shape for a stop sign when every single driver already knows to hit the brakes the second they see a red octagon?
That is a perfect analogy. The reliance on existing user mental models here is a masterstroke.
It saves so much effort.
Right, because consider the target demographic. Chinese users have interacted with that exact WeChat green bubble hundreds of thousands of times.
It is second nature.
Exactly. By lifting that specific visual language and transplanting it into the web client, the developer drops the user's cognitive load to absolute zero.
The brain just processes the interface instinctively.
Right. There is no learning curve whatsoever.
And they applied that same logic to the user sending media back to the AI. They built this two-phase upload system.
Which is so necessary.
It is. When you pick a photo to send, it doesn't just instantly fire off to the server. It pops up in a little preview strip at the bottom of your screen, complete with a tiny X icon.
Just in case.
Yeah, it only transmits when you explicitly hit the send button. That entirely eliminates the panic of accidentally sending an embarrassing photo from your camera roll.
We have all been there. It provides safety and control. However, having a beautifully synchronized, equal experience between the Telegram app and the web browser is entirely pointless if a new user gives up before they even get inside.
Oh, yeah. Which brings us to the front door of the application, the onboarding process.
Hey, onboarding.
The developer essentially took a sledgehammer to the initial user flow. In the very first iteration of this app, there were 14 distinct questions a user had to answer just to start chatting.
14 questions is a lot.
It is an interrogation. Then they whittled it down to 4, and in this 1.1.1 update, they have slashed it down to just 3 questions.
Amazing.
But the revolutionary change isn't just the sheer number of questions, it is the sequence. They shifted the flow so that the system asks for the relationship type before it asks for the AI's nickname.
Because the older flow asked, who are you, and then how do we interact? And that sequence feels logically sound to a programmer. But from a behavioral standpoint, it puts the cart before the horse.
And the genius of scrapping them lies in the dynamic suggestion.
Oh, the dynamic suggestions are so smart.
Yeah, the source material details a programming pattern they used called Dependson, tied to an options map.
Lots of jargon there.
Right. To demystify that jargon, it basically means a conditional logic tree. If you make choice A, the system alters the menu for choice B.
Give us an example.
So if you tell the AI first that you want it to act as your romantic partner, using the Chinese term O, the interface dynamically populates the nickname suggestions with terms of endearment.
Like what?
Like Mo, which means baby, or a she, meaning wife. Conversely, if you select that you just want a platonic good friend, Ta Achidori, the dropdown alters itself to suggest things like Ken, meaning classmate.
That is so context aware.
It really is. The developer points out a brilliant relational truth here. A friend calling you baby is creepy, but a partner calling you classmate is incredibly cold.
Yeah, nobody wants their partner calling them classmate. It establishes the emotional boundary lines immediately, preventing the user from accidentally setting up a jarring dynamic.
I do want to challenge this ruthless simplification, though. Let me put on my devil's advocate hat for a second.
Okay, go for it.
As a user who loves to customize my digital tools, taking away 11 onboarding questions feels like a downgrade.
Mm-hmm.
Furthermore, from an engineering perspective, doesn't an AI model thrive on massive amounts of context?
Why?
By slashing the questionnaire down to 3 inputs, aren't we essentially starving the AI of the rich data it needs to actually be personalized?
That is a very common concern when streamlining software, but it misunderstands the principle of zero information lost.
Zero information lost.
Yeah. You are entirely correct that an AI model requires deep contextual data to perform well. But the system does not necessarily need to interrogate the user to acquire it.
Okay, how else does it get it?
Let's look at a specific example from the update. In the previous version, one of those deleted questions asked the user to manually select their time zone from a massive scrolling drop-down menu. Ugh,
the worst.
In version 0.1.1, that step is gone. The developer simply used a built-in browser function called Intel Datetime Format.
What does that do?
That little piece of code quietly reaches into the user's operating system, grabs the precise time zone data, and hands it to the AI automatically.
Oh, wow. Why force a human to fill out a form for data the computer already has sitting in its own memory?
Precisely. Forcing a user to manually select UTC-8 Pacific time is pure friction.
Totally.
And regarding the relationship questions, asking a few smart, conditionally linked questions gathers vastly more accurate emotional context than a long, exhausting survey.
That makes sense.
They also integrated gender-neutral defaults and highly inclusive labels, systematically eliminating subtle points of alienation.
Getting out of the user's way.
Yes. The ultimate metric for the developer is getting the user from the landing page to their first meaningful interaction with the AI in under 60 seconds.
And once the user breezes through that frictionless front door and defines the relationship, the pressure shifts to the AI.
Big time.
Because it has to actually deliver on the promise. This requires moving beyond generic prompt engineering into deep cultural and relational tuning.
It is the difference between commanding an AI to just be nice versus programming an AI to understand the social obligations of a specific dynamic.
And the source notes that the romantic partner relationship was significantly upgraded for two specific personas in the system, the Mimigrimi and Suruzoji characters.
Right.
In previous versions, selecting the romantic option just made them generically agreeable.
Like a customer service bot.
Yeah, exactly. Now, the developer has scripted highly specific behaviors. These personas will actively show affection, display realistic jealousy, express that they miss the user if they haven't logged in for a while, and even initiate specific goodnight routines.
They are no longer just answering questions. They are actively participating in the established social script of a relationship.
Which is wild. And the update to the Ki-Tami persona is even more striking.
Oh, the Taiwanese character.
Yes, Ki is specifically designed as a Taiwanese character. In this 0.1.1 release, her entire underlying persona was rewritten structurally in traditional Chinese.
That is a huge distinction.
The developer is explicit about the nuance here. It isn't just about the visual look of the characters. It is about vocabulary.
But like specific word choices.
Exactly. She now uses E instead of he for the word software. She uses A instead of she for messages.
Small changes, but they matter.
They matter so much. To put this in perspective, imagine watching a movie set in Deep South Texas.
Okay.
If an actor from London just mimics the accent, but uses British slang like lorry or flat, the illusion shatters immediately.
Oh, instantly. Anyone local spots the fake.
Right. Running simplified Chinese through a cheap software converter to get.
Yeah.
Traditional Chinese yields the same uncanny valley effect. It's the difference between actually being a Taiwanese character and being an algorithm doing a hollow impression of one.
Language cannot be divorced from identity. Words carry heavy cultural baggage, historical context, and regional flavor.
Absolutely.
By forcing the AI's foundational prompt to think in traditional Chinese, the model's entire conceptual framework and phrasing inherently shift to match the culture. The illusion holds up because the architectural foundation is authentic.
Okay, here's where it gets really interesting.
Okay, hit me.
Building deeply nuanced AIs that can simulate authentic cultural identity, send voice notes, and generate spontaneous selfies creates a magnificent user experience.
It does.
But it introduces an absolutely terrifying reality for the developer who has to pay the server bill.
Oh, server bills!
We are talking about the hidden costs of generative AI.
The financial reality of scaling these models is often what kills promising prototypes.
So the developer introduces a new feature in this update. A dark-themed admin cost dashboard.
Essential.
Imagine moving into a new high-tech house. Everything is automated. At the end of the month, you get your very first highly itemized electricity bill, and you suddenly realize your fancy new smart toaster is drawing 10 times more power than your entire refrigerator.
Oh, that is a terrible feeling.
Right. That feeling of shock is exactly what this dashboard was built to uncover.
The dashboard provides four critical lenses for the developer: a summary of total spend, a category breakdown, recent transactions, and a daily cost chart.
Which one is the smart toaster?
That category breakdown panel is where they discovered their metaphorical smart toaster. The metrics revealed that generating a single image using the Gemini API was 10 times more expensive per call than generating a text-to-speech voice message.
10 times. Just for a selfie.
10 times. The computational weight of rendering an image from scratch is just vastly heavier than synthesizing audio.
That is wild, but I guess it makes sense.
When you are attempting to scale software to thousands of users, visibility is synonymous with survival. An engineer cannot optimize, and certainly cannot rate limit, a cost they cannot see.
And the recent transactions panel acts like a digital burglar alarm, The developer notes it is designed to catch anomalies. The example they give is spotting a single user suddenly generating 50 selfies in a single hour.
Yeah, seeing 50 heavy API calls from one account in 60 minutes is a glaring red flag.
What does that usually mean?
It usually points to one of two things, either a critical system breakage, like a code base caught in an infinite loop, or a malicious user actively trying to abuse the platform's resources.
Wow, so that dashboard paid for itself immediately.
Oh, absolutely. The dashboard also helped them catch a data reporting bug. They noticed their daily cost aggregations were entirely skewed.
Why?
It turned out some database queries were grouping costs using the server's local time, while others were using UTC, you know, Universal Coordinated Time.
Oh no, time zones again.
If your time zones are misaligned, your daily financial charts become completely useless noise.
Time zones really are the bane of every programmer's existence.
They really are.
But the spiraling costs weren't limited to the API calls to Gemini and Fish Audio. Mm. The developer also had to confront the physical storage of the database itself. The actual data footprint of the ongoing conversations was becoming a massive liability.
Right, because chat history is a classic engineering trap. It grows linearly.
Every single message adds up.
Every single day, the database gets larger, heavier, and more expensive to maintain.
I mean, if you only have 10 beta testers kicking the tires on a prototype, keeping every single message forever is trivial.
Sure.
But the developer realized that for a mature product, hoarding every text log indefinitely is a ticking time bomb.
It is unsustainable.
So their solution is shockingly ruthless. They built what is called a Pujicron job.
A Pujicron job.
Yeah, a cron job is essentially a scheduled robotic janitor that runs automated scripts. Every single day at 4.0 a.m. UTC, which is intentionally scheduled during off-peak hours for their predominantly Asian user base, this digital janitor sweeps through the database and permanently deletes any chat message older than 30 days.
Gone forever.
There are no soft deletes where the data is hidden but kept. There is no transfer to cheap cold storage. The messages are just wiped from existence.
And on a technical level, they supported this mass deletion by implementing a B-tree index on the created dat timestamp in the database.
Okay, we need to break that down. What is a B-tree index and why is it necessary for deleting old messages?
Well, without an index, the database would have to perform a full table scan.
Which means?
Imagine being handed a 10,000-page dictionary and being told to cross out every word that starts with the letter Z.
That would take ages.
Exactly. Without tabs, you would have to read every single page from A all the way to Y just to find the Z. It takes forever, and the system would likely lock up and crash while trying to do it.
That sounds like a nightmare.
A B-tree index is the equivalent of adding those alphabetized thumb tabs to the edge of the dictionary pages. At 4 a.m., the system just grabs the older than 30 days tab, instantly isolates the batch of old messages, and drops them cleanly without scanning the rest of the active database.
Hold on, I need to stop you there because I have a major philosophical issue with this.
Oh, really?
Yeah. Everything we are told in the modern tech landscape is that data is the new oil.
Oh, I see where you're going with this.
These massive tech conglomerates hoard every scrap of data they can get their hands on to train their models. Why on earth would a developer intentionally, permanently destroy the raw, authentic conversational logs of their users?
It seems backwards, right?
Completely. What if a user wants to scroll back 6 months to reread a profoundly comforting message the AI sent them during a tough time? By wiping the logs to save a few dollars on cloud storage, aren't they actively destroying the user's memories and the intrinsic value of the data set?
I completely understand the emotional resistance to deleting user data. It feels counterintuitive to everything we know about the AI gold rush.
It just feels wrong.
But you have to examine the specific architecture of Mio. The developer's approach acknowledges that while data might be the new oil, raw chat logs are crude oil.
They're crude oil.
Okay. They are messy, highly repetitive, and demand massive storage infrastructure. Mio operates with a secondary, specialized, long-term memory system.
Oh, I see.
Yeah, within that 30-day window before deletion, the AI model has already combed through the raw conversation, extracted the critical facts, analyzed the user's preferences, and distilled the emotional context. It saves those refined insights into its permanent memory banks.
Oh, okay. I see where that leads. The system already extracted the refined gasoline, so it doesn't need to keep the heavy barrels of crude oil sitting in the warehouse.
Exactly that. The raw verbatim logs become totally redundant the moment the extraction process completes.
It would just be double storage.
Right. Why pay compounding server costs to store redundant data? As the developer so perfectly articulated in their notes, a product that grows without bound isn't a product, it's a liability.
So what does this all mean? We started this deep dive looking at a seemingly insignificant 0.1.1 version bump in a developer's changelog.
Just a tiny decimal.
But what we've really uncovered is that masterful software engineering is almost entirely invisible to the person using it.
It really is.
Building a mature product is an exercise in removing friction, like abandoning the time zone question, because the browser can fetch it silently.
And removing waste.
Exactly. Ruthlessly eliminating waste. Like deploying that robotic janitor to delete redundant chat logs and building dashboards to hunt down anomaly API costs.
It takes so much work to make something feel effortless.
By managing that cold back-end pragmatism flawlessly, the developer ensures that the actual magic of the AI, the nuanced Taiwanese vocabulary, the voice notes, the perfectly timed selfies, can shine through without bankrupting the creator in the process.
You know, this raises an important question, though. Something to really chew on that wasn't explicitly covered in the developer's update.
What's that?
The architecture dictates that the AI ruthlessly deletes the verbatim conversation after 30 days, keeping only the extracted facts in its permanent memory system.
Right.
But does a system eventually lose the subtle emotional texture of how we communicate when it only remembers the what?
Oh, that is a great point.
If you and I have a deep conversation, I don't just remember the bullet points. I remember your tone, your hesitations, the specific strange phrasing you used when you were vulnerable.
The human element.
Yes.
Yeah.
If an AI system relies entirely on distilled, extracted data points, does a digital relationship built purely on those facts eventually feel more like reading a dry Wikipedia summary of a person rather than actually experiencing the warmth of a romance?
Oh, wow. That is a truly haunting thought. A relationship ultimately reduced to bullet points in a database.
It makes you wonder.
It really does. It brings us right back to the tension we started with. As humans, we crave the magic, the spontaneity of voice notes, the messy reality of genuine connection. We don't just want the sterile text.
Not at all.
And even as brilliant developers build these incredibly sophisticated systems to mimic that magic, there will always be a profound tension between the emotional heart of the user and the cold, unyielding reality of the database.
Beautifully said.
Thank you so much for joining us on this deep dive today. We hope you continue to question and explore the hidden mechanics and the invisible design decisions behind the digital tools you rely on every single day. See you next time.